Maine's Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, with a goal of donating 30,000 meals to the Good Shepherd Food Bank this November. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Maine Public's Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and Senior Political Correspondent Mal Leary. Let's begin with a bit more post-mortem analysis of Susan Collins' successful defense of her Senate seat. Steve, what did we learn from her chief of staff, Steve Abbott?
Oh, it was an interesting conversation with Steve, who, is sort of the architect of Collins's re-election, which, you know, surprised a lot of people, or at least in terms of how decisive it was. And, Steve is, I think a lot of reporters know, is someone you can talk to on background, but it's rare to get him to talk on tape or on the record. And we were fortunate enough to speak with him about what happened, at least from his vantage point. It was interesting because, you know, he acknowledged that back in, you know, shortly after impeachment, that Susan Collins, at least according to their own internal polling, was in deep trouble. You know, she was down pretty significantly in a head-to-head with Democratic challenger Sarah Gideon. And specifically, this polling took place after Collins's comment to Nora O'Donnell of CBS News, when she said that that the president had learned his lesson from impeachment, which of course continued to shadow her throughout, you know, for months, if not longer than that, and was used by Gideon and her allies. But from Steve's telling, which I thought was interesting, they saw the pandemic really actually ended up saving Collins in a lot of ways, because she was able to craft that Paycheck Protection Program legislation, which ended up providing forgivable loans to businesses. Now, there were a lot of problems with that program, especially at the launch. And it was, you know, it was criticized for having carve-outs for big corporations and that sort of thing. But it was something that Collins could campaign on locally and demonstrate that she had, you know, delivered relief for Mainers. And that was sort of a theme, I think, of the tack that they took throughout the campaign, you know, just trying to demonstrate that Collins has delivered for Mainers. And it was a contrast with Gideon, because the legislature had been out since March. From his view, that was the beginning of them beginning to turn it around. It helped her localize the race. And I think that that was ultimately what helped her win the race.
And I think it's pretty clear that that was her theme herself. Once things got rolling and she could point to all of these most recent things that she had done, things started to turn around. Their internal polling consistently showed them doing better than what the public polls were showing.
Steve, as you mentioned, and it's true, I mean, she ended up winning by a comfortable margin. But I think it also has to be said, too, that the percentage of votes she got, which was in the very low 50s, still stands in marked contrast to 6 years earlier, when she got about 68, 69% of the vote. And so you're still seeing some lingering effect, primarily, I suspect, for her vote confirming Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. You know, she can take a victory lap because of how decisive that victory was. But your point is the right one. You know, you're starting to see a little bit of a pivot now to address the problem that you just laid out, Erwin, which is that loss of support. You know, now with the Biden administration and what appears to be Republicans poised at the moment to, you know, retain the majority that they have, there's a lot of chatter about, you know, whether there's a bipartisan mandate and how would Susan Collins fit into that. I'm a little bit skeptical of bipartisan mandates, because they never seem to work out in this age, especially right now. You know, we'll see how it goes. The interesting conversation I had with Jessica Taylor from the Cook Political Report provided what I thought was some pretty interesting analysis about polling in the race and how we thought Donald Trump at the top of the ticket would drag Republicans. But what Jessica told me was very interesting. She thought that actually helped Republicans in the sense that finally voters who were upset with Donald Trump, you know, they finally could punish him and not just the Republican Party. And I think there might be something to that if you go back, especially in the closing weeks of the election, when this narrative was building about Biden's inevitability. There was even talk of a landslide, which obviously didn't happen. And how that may have persuaded some people who were on the fence about Susan Collins to vote for her. You know, some of those folks may have been worried about Susan Collins in a second term under Trump. She'd be facing more pressure. Perhaps some of those voters are like, well, Biden's going to win anyway, so we're safe to vote for Susan Collins and send her back, which they probably wanted to do anyway.
Whereas in 2018, people who were upset with Trump had to vote against Republicans in Congress. This time around, they didn't have to. And as a result, Republicans tended to do much better in congressional races around the country this year than they did 2 years ago.
And to both of your points, this goes to the incredible complexity of how a person decides how they're going to vote. Very few people are, you know, strictly going to vote on the question of Kavanaugh's confirmation, for example, or on abortion. They vote on a number of issues, and a lot of it boils down to that issue that Ed Muskie used to talk about, and that is trust. They may not like you for this bill or that vote or this vote, but if they trust that you're trying to do what's right, they still may vote for you.
Yeah, one other thing I'd just point out, going back to 2012, and this is another statistic courtesy of Jessica Taylor, 122 of 139 Senate races have gone the same way as the presidential race in their state. So their presidential preference lined up with the party preference in the Senate races. In 2016, it was every single Senate race. And this year, while we have two runoffs in Georgia to be decided, the only one that broke differently than the presidential race was right here in Maine with Susan Collins. That was the only Senate race in the country so far that broke differently than the actual presidential preference.
Something else that's come up, as long as we were talking about President Trump and the presidential election, of course, the president-elect now in the process of assembling a cabinet, and there has been some chatter, or at least a suggestion by a couple of liberal groups, Steve, that Shelley Pingree, the first district Democratic congresswoman, would be a good choice for agriculture secretary.
Justice Democrats and the Sunrise Movement, which are very progressive groups, are making this push and trying to see if, you know, if President-elect Biden would, you know, tap Pingree as agriculture secretary. It appears just from the national reporting that we've seen that she would be a long shot to do that. And I'm not even certain that she's interested in it, given that she's increasing in seniority and is on the Appropriations Committee in the House. So, you know, the ones that we keep hearing about that are the front runners are Heidi Heitkamp, the senator from North Dakota. Amy Klobuchar has been floated a couple of times. Marsha Fudge, who's a congresswoman from Ohio, who would be the first African-American woman appointed to that position. Those are the ones that we hear about more frequently than Pingree, but Pingree is certainly, you know, potentially a consideration for Biden.
Now, let's take a couple of minutes to talk about some stuff a little bit closer to home, one of which is the new legislature, when it convenes in a few weeks, is going to deal with constitutional officers. Talk a little bit about what's up there.
Well, at the moment, and of course, things change rapidly in this short period between the election and the constitutional convention that elects them. The only battleground seems to be the Secretary of State, where I think we're up to seven candidates now. Whoa. That have mentioned that they're running. We could well have someone else jump in, or we could have a couple of them drop out. They are elected by the legislature, and that's a joint convention of the legislature, House and Senate together, and the majority rules. Now, the person the Democrats nominate should win because of the size of the margin they have. The other two constitutional offices that are up, State Treasurer Henry Beck, has no opposition so far, nor does Attorney General Aaron Fry. So it'll be pretty quick with those two, unless somebody comes out of the woodwork and does run. With that many candidates running, and if they all stay in, it's going to be a very long day just to deal with winnowing out to the final person to get the nomination, which then goes to the full legislature the next day to actually be elected.
The way they select these candidates isn't it essentially like a type of runoff style, or almost a ranked choice type style. Is that correct?
What they do is they keep dropping off, like in ranked choice, until somebody has a majority. What's different is that because of the nature of the beast, in the middle of it, you could have somebody drop out, which changes the dynamic as well. So it can get very complicated. I've seen them where, you know, a couple of people dropped out of a four or five person race, and then all of a sudden it's three people, and then bingo, you've got a nominee.
And the other thing that's been being sorted out is legislative leadership. main Democrats in the House have chosen Ryan Becto of Biddeford to be the next speaker. What do we know about him?
He was the assistant majority leader. He ran sort of a traditional campaign for speaker, had a leadership pack that helped candidates with some funding during the election. He went out and campaigned for people. Pretty traditional. He is the first openly gay speaker to be elected here in Maine, or at least nominated at this point. The makeup of the leadership goes from Fechtow on the Democratic side to Michelle Dunphy, who's married to outgoing Secretary of State Matt Dunlap, and then Rachel Talbot Ross. Arguably, right there between those two, you've got quite a breadth of the Democratic caucus, from the more conservative to the very progressive. And that's going to be one of the big issues I see going forward. Governor Mills is going to have as much problem with some of the progressive members of her party as she does dealing with the Republicans.
That tension, if you will be especially acute this year. We're facing a very difficult budget proposal from the governor. I'm certain of that, you know, and we may have, you know, people may have to wait till next year to get that. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mel, but I'm pretty certain that a lot of our revenue projections are based off of a COVID relief bill that hasn't arrived yet. So the budget picture in Maine is about to get pretty grim. I think we're doing okay. At least, you know, we've been able to, Governor Mills has been able to keep segments of the economy running, but it's still not at full tilt. That hurts at the end of the day, especially in a state like Maine where, you know, we're so dependent on the service economy, and services are the ones that are hardest hit in this particular pandemic.
This is really worrisome news with a slight uptick in unemployment claims. A lot of folks are exhausting their claims, and the federal extended benefit program is about to run out. So those kind of factors have a huge impact on the state budget. What the governor's put forth is kind of a framework, could be well short of what's needed if indeed there's no help coming from Washington at all.
You know, you mentioned the unemployment, but there's like something like almost 3,000 people that applied for rental relief. You know, people are hurting out there, and, you know, that is going to percolate up into the session that's coming up, especially since this is the year when we have the next 2-year budget. And so there's going to be a lot of tension, a lot of fighting, certainly, you know, fighting between Democrats and Republicans about it. And certainly there's going to be some tension between the executive branch with Governor Mills and the Democrats in the legislature, which have majorities. But just because they're from the same party doesn't mean they all always agree.
Well, Mel, Steve, thank you both very much, as usual.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. We update this podcast each Friday. You can download the latest version from our website, mainepublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can hear most of the Pulse on Weekend Edition Sunday, and we provide an excerpt on each Monday's Morning Edition. We also have the Maine Political Pulse newsletter, which you can subscribe to at mainepublic.org. It is also updated on Fridays. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz, and a thank you to you, too, because Maine's Political Pulse, like everything we do at Maine Public, is supported by your contributions. I'm Erwin Gratz. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you soon.